You're listening to a podcast from funnyinthemiddle.com.
Hi, we dig music, and because of this, we've kept the music in our podcast at a low background level because we believe that you should support the artists by buying their records and going to their gigs. If you want to hear the songs in full, we've made Spotify playlists of all available music featured in each episode, which you can find on funnyinthemiddle.com. You can also join in the discussion on Facebook and Twitter by searching at WeDigMusicPcast. Finally, if you dig what you're hearing, please subscribe to us on your podcast app of choice, write a review if possible, and tell all your friends that you think would enjoy it. Anyway, enough of my yakking, on with the podcast.
Hello, welcome to episode 9 of We Dig Music. I'm Tracy, and with me are my co-hosts, Beavis and Butthead. Colin.
Hello.
And Ian.
Hello.
So, as you know by now, in each episode, we take a letter of the alphabet and talk about two bands, one well-known and one not so well-known. And as you also may know, we often take the scenic route and get lost in a few tangents.
Particularly on the last couple of episodes.
Yes. So, in this episode, we will be doing the letter I, which means we're going to be talking about The Imagined Village and Iron Maiden. So, as usual, we'll start with the lesser-known band, which is The Imagined Village. Imagined who?
The Imagined Village.
And The Imagined Village. I think that was your choice, wasn't it, Colin?
So, it was.
Please, tell us something about them.
Okay. See the light, set alight. It is time. This is our beginning in the sound. We are found. It is time for our winter singing. So, The Imagined Village, they're a musical project, which later became a band, put together by Afro-Celt sound system guitarist and producer Simon Emerson. They're more of a collective than a band. It was the first album was almost like a compilation album. The idea that Simon Emerson had was to modernise traditional English folk songs by bringing in sort of more multicultural sounds to reflect how, you know, English society is in 2004, which it was when he formed the band, and it still is now. I'm not saying it's not multicultural now, I'm saying that was when they formed the band. But to do this, he basically got together some English folk musicians, such as Eliza Carthy, Martin Carthy and Chris Wood, who are all folk legends. And then he'd also got him doing sort of electronic-y type things in there, but he brought in Shima Mukherjee as the sitar player, Johnny Kalsi on dol, which is like the big Indian drum, and Andy Ganjadeen on drums, who's an Indian drummer who's now plays drums for Chase and Status when they play live. They had loads of collaborators on the first album. They had Billy Bragg, they had Paul Weller, they had the Young Copper family. So the Copper family are an old folk family who have been going back for generations. They were one of the first folk musicians to be recorded in the 1950s when they started sort of documenting all of the old songs that had just been passed down for generations. And the first song on the first album, there's a recorded bit of speech on there, which is from John Copper, I think it is, who's the grandfather of one of the Young Copper family, who are also featured on the album. And that's sort of, you know, part of the folk tradition of passing it down, the songs down through the ages. But
they're sort of updating the songs, which a lot of sort of in folk circles there are a lot of purists who aren't always that open to change.
Right.
Even though the way folk, the whole point of folk music is it's music passed down orally rather than written down to different generations. So it's going to change over the years when you do it. But I know from my experience, I've played gigs in folk clubs. And if you play something that doesn't fit into their really narrow definition of folk, there are some musicians that will be almost hostile. I played at a gig that there were some very sort of strongly purist folk musicians, and I introduced a song, as I quite often do, as being an old English folk song about gambling, which is my cover of The Ace of Spades by Motorhead. Mm. And they were not happy at all.
I hate to take a tangent so early in the episode, but Aidan Moffat from Arab Strap.
Oh, here we go.
Ian's favourite.
Ian's favourite. Aidan did a film called Where You're Meant to Be.
Yes.
Which was about the Scottish folk tradition. And I forget her name. What was her name? Sheila...
McGig.
Sheila McGig. She's a... a traditional Scottish traveller folk musician. Nice. And so she was doing this tour with Aidan Moffat, and they were taking the folk songs, and she took absolute umbrage to him changing the lyrics to one of the songs to bring it up to date. And I think also he turned it into something like Glasgow about drinking and fighting or something. And she freaked. She went mad at him. And it's in the film, like her telling him that... he can't do that, and he's saying, why not? Why can't I change the lyrics and update them?
My thoughts on that are those people are completely missing the point. The whole thing is it's passed on from generation to generation. It's not written down, so it's not set in stone. That is the whole point of it. You know, if you look at an old folk song, you can look at loads of different versions by different people, and they're going to be, you know, you might have some of the tune the same, or you might have some of the lyrics the same, but you're not going to have the whole thing sort of identical.
No.
That's the whole point of it.
I was watching a YouTube video of the Imagine Village in the run-up to this, and Billy Bragg talking about Scarborough Fair, and with Martin Carthy there, in fact. And it was Martin Carthy who actually introduced that song to Paul Simon.
Martin Carthy.
And then years later, of course, the Stone Roses completely ripped it off. So so there we are. There's the later adaptation of the song.
Yes, those famous folk purists, the Stone Roses. Martin Carthy is probably, I mean, even though it's Simon Emerson that's put the band together, he's kind of like the sort of elder statesman of the band.
Absolutely.
And I think that they've, see, the first two albums were entirely old folk songs updated. The third album, they completely wrote new ones, and I can't remember which member of the band said it, but it was basically... one of the band said, we can't just keep doing things out of the Martin Carthy songbook.
I saw Martin Carthy live the beginning of this year, and he's just amazing.
He's great. I've only ever seen him with the Imagine Village.
Yeah.
But I got into the Imagine Village completely by accident. I was in London in 2009, and we'd just been to the London Bridge Experience, which has got absolutely nothing to do with London Bridge other than it being next to London Bridge. And it's one of these like horror things, a bit like the London Dungeon.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
But it's basically you're walking through a maze while people with chainsaws are jumping out at you and stuff. Very entertaining. But we were walking back to the tube stop where you have to go past the Tower of London, and there was a World Music Festival on at the Tower of London. And we walked past, and there's some music on there. And I heard a voice that I recognised, and it was Billy Bragg. Obviously, he's got a really recognisable voice.
Yeah.
And I'm a big Billy Bragg fan. And I was just
as we know.
Brilliant. So
free Billy Bragg gig.
Yeah, well, it was all fenced off,
yeah,
but there was a little gap in the fence, so I ended up standing there watching for about sort of 4 or 5 songs, because we'd got to go and get food, unfortunately. But yeah, they were great. I then bought the album. I was about probably 4 or 5 years late into getting the album, because the second album came out not long after that.
Yeah. I haven't got any of them, actually. I mean, I've kind of heard of them, and I've always meant to go and see them live, because I know that, you know, they're meant to be amazing live. I mean, the amount of people they have on stage.
They've had about 20 on stage.
Yeah, I saw when they were on Jules Holland.
Yeah.
And yeah, there's loads of them. And like, you know, and like you said, the tradition, it's got the sitars, it's got that Indian drum, but the keyboards everywhere.
Yeah, well, this is the thing with Simon Emerson. He's in Afro-Celt Sound System, where their sort of main thing is mixing Celtish folk type music with Afrobeat sort of sounds. But it's all done, it's all tied together with his electronic sort of stuff. And it does have a habit of sounding dated as soon as he's recorded it. He uses a lot of synths and keyboards that don't really...
See, that's what I thought about this,
yeah,
to be honest. It sounded super contrived to me.
I can get what you hear.
And when I was looking up on the Wikipedia, I was like, oh, Paul Weller's involved. Wow. That's not a fucking surprise.
Only on one song.
But it's just, I feel like if you're doing music and then you think, let's get Weller involved, you've probably fucked up at that point.
Stone Foundation are doing all right out of
it. I don't like it, though.
No, fair enough.
So, I mean, if you want me on board,
yeah, don't.
Probably don't involve Weller, because he just ruins everything nowadays.
I guess I concentrate more on Eliza Carthy, though, in the Imagine Village.
So do I.
I've been an Eliza Carthy fan for years. I love her early albums, you know, when she was like, you know, full on folk pixie ethereal mode.
Red Rice.
Red Rice, Anglicana. So, I mean, yeah, proper English folk tradition. So I've always loved her voice. But Martin Carthy as well.
And her violin playing as well.
Yeah, yeah, her violin playing.
So for people that don't know, Eliza Carthy's Martin Carthy's daughter. So it's like the folk tradition passed through the family.
Does Norma, Eliza Carthy's mother, does she feature in the Imagine Village at all?
No, fairly sure she doesn't.
Norma, her voice is an acquired taste, shall we say.
It's not Norma Waterson.
Norma Waterson, yeah, and she features on a James Yorkston album, another Scottish folk musician. She's on the When the Ha Rolls In album, and it fucking takes you by surprise when she starts singing. It's like a foghorn.
This is the thing with, if you're not used to English folk singing, it can. If you're growing up like all of us have, listening to pop music, the folk singing can seem really sort of abrasive. We've got friends. I mean, our friend Liz, who's the violinist in me and Tracy's band, she grew up listening more to folk music than listening to you know, rock and pop music. So she's introduced me to loads of it, and some of it really, for me, takes a lot of work to get yourself into the right mindset to listen to some of the voices.
Yeah.
And it's just because of it's frames of reference again. It's not what I'm used to hearing so much. I mean, even a lot of the British singers that I like, they're affecting an American accent when they sing and that kind of thing, whereas English folk is very, very, very English.
Well, yeah, I mean, when you listen to Martin Carthy sing, his Yorkshire accent comes through so strongly.
But I think with the Imagine Village, I think the first album is the most electronic, and the second album, they cut back the electronics a lot. It's a lot more acoustic instruments, still mixed with the sitar and the doll.
I love that mix, though.
I fucking hated it. Like, I if you're gonna do it occasionally. But it was like, hey, there's folk stuff, there's a sitar. There's folk stuff, there's a sitar. Like, I get it. There's a sitar guy in your band. That's fucking wicked.
It's a sitar lady.
It's a lady.
Well, okay, sorry. But still, I just... Like we were saying the other day, like, you've got all these instruments. You don't have to use them all the fucking time.
You shouldn't hide them, though.
I think they should. I think sometimes they should. There's a time and a place for it. And the time is not all the fucking...
I
prefer a multi-instrumentalist to a just in this kind of context. I think it would be cool to bring in a variety of multicultural instruments, not just
using the
this
same
is what
genre.
We have.
Yeah, okay, I can dig that.
Like,
they need glockenspiel then, obviously.
I think there's a bit of glockenspiel here.
Is there?
I saw a band called Wardruna the other day. Traditional. Like, very traditional Scandinavian folk music, but that, like, three of them were multi-instrumentalists.
Yeah.
Playing at Hellfest. Yeah.
Which is a heavy metal festival in France.
It was the most intense thing I saw all weekend. But it was not progressive, not modern. Yeah. It was very, very,
very
traditional, But they, you know, just like, this instrument is cool for this song. Now we'll put it down and pick up another instrument. And that's what I would have liked, a little bit more variety. It all seemed very...
I think that happens a little bit. It might have been the selection that I'd chosen on the playlist, possibly.
Ah, so maybe you're the reason
it's possible. I'd gone for my sort of favourite kind of tracks on there, and what I thought was representative, but it could be that it's a bit different.
It sounded super middle-aged to me.
It is... It's very middle-aged Guardian Reader.
It's like... That's,
you can't get away from that kind of... It was on... The first album was on Peter Gabriel's Real World Records.
Right.
Which does tell you a lot to start with.
It just chafed a little bit. It's like you don't mean what you're doing. You don't... This is not... There's not a lot of intent there. It's like, I think it would be interesting to do this. Not, I fucking want to do this, I want to create this, it's going to be fucking amazing.
I think the third album, which didn't feature on the playlist because I didn't listen to it until I was revising for this podcast and suddenly went, holy shit, why didn't I buy this album sooner? It's fucking brilliant. That's probably a bit more, because it's their own songs.
Yeah.
Rather than their reinterpreting
the folk
songs. I think
like My Son John and the Martin Carthy songs.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But I think maybe it integrates the sounds a bit better on there. I mean, the only track I put on there is there's a track called Get Kelsey, which is Johnny Kelsey's, like, I'm gonna play some absolutely awesome doll drumming on there.
Yeah.
I think he's like the band's secret weapon.
He was on that Jules Holland appearance.
Yeah,
and he just dances around like mad.
He actually one of my mates at work actually had doll lessons from him. I found
really?
That. I was just randomly talking about the Imagine Village to a mate at work, and I knew he played doll, and I was like, have you ever heard of a guy called Johnny Kelsey? And he was like, yeah. Everyone has. He's in sort of the Sikh community.
Yeah.
Really, really well known, apparently.
Superstar DJ kind of status.
He's part of the Doll Foundation, which is they're a band that tour and stuff, but they also do a lot of lessons.
Right.
So quite a lot of traditional Sikh drummers have gone to the Doll Foundation for lessons from what I was told by Ammon the other day.
Right.
So it's weird because it's completely out of my frame of reference, but I absolutely love it. I mean, I've always loved the sort of Indian sort of rhythms.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I quite like...
Like Ravi Shankar or something.
Yeah, I mean, he's... it's more like the percussion kind of things
yeah.
that I like, and It's interesting because it's. I was trying to think of things to tie in the Imagine Village with Iron Maiden, whether they're, because I always like looking to see if there are connections. And there's a couple that I can think of.
Yeah.
And one of them is like a musical rhythmic kind of thing, because the Indian sort of traditional rhythms use a lot of like galloping triplet beats.
And that is Maiden's sound.
Maiden's sound is that. But also, it's the sort of underlying theme of Englishness.
Well, that's
Iron Maiden
true.
Are a very, very, you know, they are they're Iron Maiden from England.
Yeah, yeah, they really are very...
So they're like a folk metal band.
Well, not so much the folk, apart from the Clansmen.
I honestly think, storytelling-wise, they are.
Let's get into that.
I'd go with that.
We'll get into that in a couple of minutes, definitely. But there's... I think there are a lot of similarities between...
Apart from the fact that I like Maiden.
And you don't like Maiden.
No. I think what you did with the playlist, you fucked me over, because you put that houses, and that's really post-rocky at the start.
I like that, it's very haunting.
So I was like, oh, this is going to be cool. No, it's not.
Who is it talking on that one?
It's one of the Copper family. I'm not sure exactly who, because there's the recorded bit of speech at the end where you can hear it, where it's obviously a much older recording.
Yeah, yeah.
That is old John Copper speaking in the 50s about how when I were a lad all this were fields.
Yeah.
Sort of thing. But yeah, that is the only song that they've done that sounds anything like that, and it is... It's a shame because it's absolutely amazing.
Yeah, like that was pretty cool. And then we got to the second song, I was like, fuck this.
I love Cold Haley Rainy Night.
I do.
Which is, that was the one that they did on the Jules Holland.
Yeah, so is that Simon?
Simon Emerson.
Yeah, that is he the one that's singing with Eliza on that?
No. I can't remember.
Who's that singing? Because I mean...
It's Chris Wood, I think.
Right.
Yeah,
right.
It's Chris Wood's on vocals on that one. Who, when I saw the Imagine Village live at Birmingham Town Hall, he was the support act as well.
Oh, right.
I
mean, because I know all the traditional ones they do, because I know Martin Carthy's back catalogue, but I didn't really know the Imagine Village at all, and I only knew them initially from that Space Girl song. Which we played at Liz's wedding, yeah, and which I played accordion on. And I loved playing that, actually. Yeah. It's a great song.
Well, I didn't know until the other day, because I, for some reason, thought that the second album was mostly old folk songs, with the odd one or two that they'd written. And I thought Space Girl was one that they'd written, because thematically, it's... You know, it's about going into space, which I didn't think there'd be an old folk song about. Mm. But it was. It's not. Obviously, it's not hundreds of years old.
So that's an older song.
But it is. It is, and
I didn't know that.
I made the interesting discovery earlier. I thought I'm going to have a listen to earlier versions of that. So I typed Space Girl into YouTube, and if you do that, YouTube thinks that you've spelt the Spice Girls wrong.
Yes, I can imagine it does.
YouTube does not seem to get...
So you had a great night that night.
It was this morning, actually. I've got Wannabe stuck in my head.
Brilliant.
But on that note, let's go on to Iron Maiden.
Yes, let us.
I left alone. My mind was blank. I needed time to think, to get the memories from my mind. What did I see? Could I believe that what I saw that night was real and not just fantasy? Just what I saw in my old dreams. Were they reflections?
So, Iron Maiden time. Iron Maiden are, I totally agree with Wikipedia on this one, an English heavy metal band formed in East London. Yes. 1975, apparently.
Yeah.
Obviously by bassist and primary songwriter Steve Harris. They have 16 studio albums, 11 live albums, 4 EPs and 7 compilations. That's pretty solid going.
That is.
I mean, they've existed for longer than I have. and it's still quality stuff.
Yeah, there's a few... you know, the odd one or two blips.
There's sketchy stuff. I mean, they've had various members over the years. I'm not a fan of the Paul Di'Anno stuff, really. Songs-wise, yes, his vocals.
The songs are great, but better on, yeah, like, better on live albums.
When you hear Bruce Dickinson sing Phantom of the Opera, you're like, oh, that song is so good.
Running Free.
Running Free, amazing song. Just not great with Paul Sanctuary. As well, I've got a live recording.
Is he the original singer, Paul Di'Anno?
Paul Di'Anno was. He was on the first few albums. I think they had a different singer just before him.
Let me scroll through this.
Ian, that is cheating.
It's not cheating. It's not. It can't be cheating. It's a fucking long article.
I think it was Paul Di'Anno who was recently jailed for benefit fraud.
It is, yes.
Really?
Yeah. Yes. Oh, he was claiming benefits.
Went on tour, didn't he?
Yeah, he went on tour and anyway. They saw the YouTube footage of his gigs.
With his not particularly subtly named Paul Di'Anno's Killers,
battle.
I believe.
Oh, is it not Paul Di'Anno's Battle Zone anymore?
Oh, it might be, I don't know. It's always got his name in it. Yeah. But, yeah, he's...
Paul Di'Anno's benefit cheats.
Yep.
So, watch out, Blaze, they're coming for you next.
Because he's always maintained that he's, like, moved away from Maiden and he's not really bothered anymore. But why is he still covering Maiden songs, and why was his band called Killers?
Because that's when people will go to his... Yeah. People aren't going to go to hear him play Battlezone songs, are they?
Not really, no. But, oh well. Anyway, Dickinson. Dickinson's the main man.
He is.
Now,
clearly if I could sing like him, I would sing everything.
Operatic.
Yep.
Well, the thing is, I got into Maiden when Blaze...
Because of the Tamworth connection.
Because of the Tamworth connection. As we've mentioned on previous podcasts, we're all from Tamworth.
The first time I saw Maiden was on the X Factor tour.
Yeah. Well, that's because your first ever gig was Bruce Dickinson just after he left, wasn't it?
Yeah. On the Balls to Picasso tour.
Blaze Bailey, for those of you who don't know, was the frontman of a Tamworth band, Wolfsbane.
Still is the frontman of a Tamworth band called
Wolfsbane. Still is.
When we're recording this, it's...
They're on tour, aren't they?
Sorry, when this goes out, rather than when we're recording,
they're back
this,
on tour again.
It'll be about a month until they're on tour.
Oh, really? Because I thought they just did like that one little comeback thing did the Tamworth Fest. What was that? That was a couple of years ago.
Yeah,
now,
they
wasn't
did
it?
Bloodstock as well, you know.
Yeah,
that was awesome.
The tent was rammed at Bloodstock.
They're playing the Asylum in Birmingham in December. I am going to get a ticket.
I'd forgotten how much I loved them.
He was so much better in Wolfsbane.
Yeah.
He's way better.
Suited Blaze so much more.
Yeah.
He suits him.
He just shouldn't have. He shouldn't have done it.
He should never have joined Maiden.
But
no.
That's when I was aware of Iron Maiden beforehand, but I'd not really listened to them. I'd heard, you know, the odd song.
Well, I can't work out that you said. I mean, what got you into music was Guns N' Roses, but then you hadn't heard Maiden. But you see, because I see Iron Maiden as like basically your gateway band, your 14-year-old metalheads.
That was earlier. When I was a 14-year-old metalhead, that was in 1996, and at that point, Blaze Bailey was in Iron Maiden. Iron Maiden played much smaller venues at that point.
Yeah, like I saw him at the Civic.
But it just seems to me that Iron Maiden seem to be that gateway metal band for so many
people. But for the period when I was that age,
yeah.
For me, it was bands like Korn and yeah. White Zombie.
I mean, I guess I'm referring more to like my younger brother. He's 18 months younger than me, so
yeah. Yeah, so he
did the whole
Iron Maiden. He would have
gotten
to Iron Maiden in the mid-80s then, when he was when they were at their peak.
And then he's like... bored of this. I've just found Sepultura. So,
I've got a bit of a soft spot for a couple of Blaze songs.
Really?
Man on the Edge off the X Factor is ace.
It's still a decent song.
Yeah.
But it's not Manhunt, is it?
It's not as good as Manhunt, by the way.
It's one of my favourite things I realised when I was revisiting Maiden is the fact that they do just write about, like, anything. Basically, I mean that's about falling down. The film,
yes.
Hence its super catchy chorus: falling down, falling down,
but it's,
falling down.
But the verses are almost basically they just sat there watching the film and they made notes.
Yeah, it's
and it's.
I mean, it must have been a slow songwriting day for Steve Harris, but it is still a great song.
But it's they're educational.
Yeah,
Like
you could definitely watch Falling Down.
Well, when I was doing A-level English, one of the things in our A-level English literature that we had to do was the poem by Samuel Taylor Coleridge, The Rime of the Ancient Mariner.
Which is basically retold.
Which is... The song Rime of the Ancient Mariner is basically the Cliff Notes summary of the poem. I did not read the poem. I listened to Power Slave by Iron Maiden, and I passed.
Amazing.
Like, that is amazing.
They are super educational, though, aren't they? Yeah. That's the thing. Like, the troopers about the charge of the Light Brigade.
Yeah.
You know.
They've just... There's, like, historical events... classic films,
yeah.
Not so classic films.
I mean, there's that To Tame a Land's about Dune.
Yeah.
And I'm sorry, that's a bit of a shitter, that song. But I heard it again.
What's
on Peace of Mind? It's the last track on Peace of Mind, which is a great album. But it just kind of lacks a little bit towards the end. Like last three songs are a bit.
Is that got The Evil That Men Do on it?
No, that's Seventh Son. No, it's the one with the trooper on it.
Oh, right,
it's got the trooper, Flight of Icarus, Revelations. So it's got some fucking bangers on it.
I don't own that many Maiden albums. I bought the first one I bought, which was the only one I had for ages, was Best of the Beast.
Yeah,
which came out while Blaze was still in the band. That was just after the X Factor, and that was the name of their album. Simon Cowell bass. Shite.
Yeah, and then they did that football themed album with him, Virtual Eleven.
It was before that because it didn't have anything on that. And I think I ignored that because it was to do with football and I hate football.
But that isn't that the one with the Klansman on it? Which it is actually a song.
Yes, but the Klansman was on a Metal Hammer free CD, so I didn't need to buy the album.
Ah, but
the
winner.
The Klansman, which is based on Braveheart.
Yeah. Which is also a historical event because, you know, William Wallace... Yeah. Real person, so
yeah,
cool.
But other than that, I mean, I bought Power Slave. I got that on cassette, and I think of all the albums I've listened to, Power Slave is absolutely amazing. There isn't a bad track on there.
No, I had coming back over to here today. I had Seventh Son on. And that's such a good album.
Yeah,
big, huge, over the top concept album about some.
That's,
you know,
that's got Can I Play With Madness on it.
Yes.
One of my favourite individual Maiden songs.
And The Evil That Men Do.
Yes.
And so, The Clairvoyant.
So it's probably one of their most melodic albums, then, I would have thought.
Yeah, well, it's the first album they had keyboards in. Everyone lost their shit because they were like, what? Yeah. You've got keyboards now? What is wrong with you?
One thing that I was trying to get my head round, and I've spoken to quite a few different people about over the last few weeks when I've been thinking about Iron Maiden for the podcast, was I can't get my head around whether Iron Maiden were considered heavy at the time. And they were. But it's because I've grown up later after their heyday. And for me, heavy was things like Pantera.
Yeah.
People are always trying to take it up a notch.
Yeah.
But I don't think that's happening now. But
I think heavy back then, I sent Kid Lightning, guy who used to run the school club in Tamworth, really big musical influence, friend of the podcast.
Yeah.
I sent him a message because he's a massive Maiden fan and asked him, and his thoughts on it were that it was more of a speed thing than a tone.
Yeah, because they were faster than...
They were fast, but they weren't...
But, I mean, it is a bit of a... Like, it's a racket, isn't it?
Yeah, but...
Really, it's super melodic, but, like, Bruce's vocals are insane.
But you've got Black Sabbath came, you know, 5 years before they formed.
Yeah.
10 years before they really started making an impact. And I can hear Black Sabbath songs now and go, that's fucking heavy.
Yeah.
You know, the riff at the end of Sabbath Bloody Sabbath. Oh shit, I just did just turn
it just went totally
yes,
went
did.
Into baby's load.
There we go. That was justified.
Yeah, my introduction was justified. I knew you'd go into Beavis and Butthead mode in this episode.
But that riff is crushingly heavy, even God, nearly 50 years later.
Yeah, but then if you think about the riff to Power Slave.
Yes.
Also heavy. So heavy, I ripped it off in my old band, SA10.
Hang on.
Seriously, nothing left.
Yes. Now you mention it.
At this point, you are meant to be making devil fingers.
I know, but I'm not doing
arms
it.
Arms aloft, like Colin just did.
But, like...
It's my natural position, generally.
They are heavy in their own way.
It's not just that they're not heavy musically. It's that, unlike someone like Guns N' Roses, the self-styled most dangerous band in the world, they don't play up the rock and roll side of it, debauchery.
No, they're
I mean,
they're super not rock and
they're
roll.
They're into golf and fishing and snooker.
But then again, Bruce Dickinson has got a fantastic old rock and roll rep. Like, he used to be pretty fucking rock and roll.
Oh, yeah. Well, they did do the drinking.
Yeah, like, I mean, I remember reading a story about him getting really, really shit-faced, going up to the sound technician after they'd played, and the bloke going, "What did you reckon?" He went, "I'll show you." And he just pissed all over the dude's sound desk.
Fuck.
So they've done it. Well, he has.
Yes. But no, I think they've all had their...
Not Dave Murray.
Does Dave Murray not... Oh, no, yeah, fair point.
He doesn't drink, but he is... He does drink, rather, but...
He's... Yeah, because he's got a pub in his house.
But he is just not really rock and roll.
No.
But I named my rabbit after him. He looks a bit rabbity, doesn't he?
He does look... Oh, man, that's amazing.
Yeah, my rabbit, Dave.
Yeah, I can see that.
This is why people don't let me name pets anymore.
But, I mean, the thing is, so I first got into Maiden... Well, in the like the fallow years when Blaine Bailey was the singer, but then Bruce Dickinson came back, Adrian Smith rejoined as well.
Yeah.
So they had a three guitar lineup for the first time, and they released The Wicker Man, which I've been trying to think of a better comeback single, and I can't.
No, it's a stellar track.
It's one of their best things they've ever done. And it's partly because they've got the energy back, but they've got the three guitar attack. I mean, Iron Maiden, there's...
It's got the whoa-ohs bit.
That's the thing. That's what I was going to go into. There are certain musical signatures that you can hear something and go, that's Iron Maiden.
Yeah.
They've got the dual guitar leads.
Yep.
With harmonies. Now they've got three-part guitar harmonies, whereas before they had two-part. It's like...
It was always three-part recorded, though.
Was it?
Yeah.
How did they do that live?
They didn't.
Okay.
That's why the live stuff, earlier stuff, sounds a bit rawer, because it's only two-part harmonies.
Ah. I've never noticed that, because, I mean, so that would be the same on Live After Death.
Yeah.
Which was the World Slavery Tour just after Power Slave was released. Mm-hmm. So it was 1986, I think, that was released. Fair enough. Okay. You're right, it is a rawer sound. I've never noticed that it was three parts on the album and two parts. But you've got there's the galloping triplet-y bass lines.
Yep.
You've got the... there was something that I'd never noticed until it was pointed out to me.
Yeah.
By my brother-in-law, who's a drummer. There's a thing that Nico McBrain, the drummer, does on the cymbal. He's keeping the time on the ride cymbal, and at the end of the bar, he'll do a little faster bit, which almost like rushes the song along. Which I don't know if I'm explaining it sort of well enough, but if you hear it, you know what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
You'll hear it in everything that they do. But then they've also got the like whoa type. Vocal bits, but when you see them live, the audience sings along to the guitar riffs. Most bands that you go to, they'll sing along with the lyrics. They're ignoring the lyrics. They're singing along with the
them and Sabbath.
Yeah, and if you ever get if you've never seen Iron Maiden live, you've got to go at this once in your life. Don't
sit either. Get down. Get in amongst it. I was last time I saw him was in Gothenburg, and I was like three rows from the front, and it was just fucking magical.
But even if you don't like heavy metal,
yeah,
even if you're a jazz fan, go and see them just for the atmosphere.
Yeah, because he's such a magnetic frontman, Dickinson. Yeah. He's very warm, very personable. You know, he's obviously talking to tens of thousands of people, but he's still like right there, and you know, he could be talking directly to you, as well, and also scream for me wherever.
Yes. Well, this is it. You've got
best thing
at the gigs. You've got people singing along with the guitar riffs. You've got Scream For Me Swindon or wherever they're playing that week. And then you've got Eddie.
Always.
The greatest band mascot of all time.
Yep.
Towards the end of the gig, usually in Running Free.
No, Iron Maiden. Iron Maiden. It's always Iron Maiden. Iron Maiden.
I knew it was an early song. Just comes out and chases
Bruce Dickinson around.
I think it was Adrian Smith when I saw him. He was chasing on the stage.
It was Yannick when I saw him.
He chases
various members of the band.
Yeah, it's like a big.
This all sounds very camp and Carry On.
It is. It's hilarious. Like, you cannot take it seriously.
So, in the early days, Eddie the Ed, which is where he got his name from.
Yeah, because he was just a head.
He was just painted on their banner originally, and they got a smoke machine where the smoke came out of his mouth.
And it used to blood used to come out of the mouth as well. But like days they could. It was just paint.
So it's kind of like
a metal
version.
All come over the drummer.
Yeah.
So it's like a metal version of Frank Sidebottom's Little Frank, then.
Yes, quite possibly.
Yeah, like it's not serious, is it?
But it's
a lot of it is.
But
the live experience.
That's how it started out. Yeah. But then later on, when they've got bigger and played larger venues, you know, he's always on the album cover to match the theme of the album artwork. So somewhere in time, he's all futuristic and that kind of thing. And then you've got Power Slave, where he's an Egyptian mummy.
Yeah, Peace of Mind, he's in a straight jacket.
Yeah, and these days, he tends to be, it's a man in a giant suit with stilts. So he's about probably 9 feet tall, bigger than that. And he just comes out and chases members of the band around the stage.
Yeah, and they'd like attack him with their guitars and run between his legs and stuff.
How did I miss that? Steve Harris machine gunning the audience with his bass guitar.
Absolutely.
Yeah, feet on the monitor. Bruce with his fist in the air. They're like rituals.
Yeah, there are like every single thing that happens at a Maiden concert happens at all of them. And that doesn't make it any worse.
No, and there's always... it's always worth looking at the merchandise store because you will never see so many different T-shirt designs.
Yep.
Because I believe that's down to Rod Smallwood, who's the band's manager.
Yeah.
Who is a financial genius. He basically has realised that there is a large percentage of Iron Maiden fans who will buy every single T-shirt that they don't own. So he gets...
Also, like the last tour, all of the bars were serving Trooper,
which is their own beer,
branded all of the bars.
Yeah,
like they're big up there on with branding, Kiss as far they? As branding is concerned.
Because Trooper beer, you might be interested in this, Ian. Trooper beer sponsored a 675 Daytona.
I know, and he's now
TT
on
Supersport.
A T-shirt.
Who, Peter Hickman?
His bike. Eddie's riding it on the latest Maiden shirt.
Is that motorbike riding?
Yes.
Yes, we've gone into motorbikes.
He
came third in the Supersport race.
You'd think Triumph as a brand would have picked up on that, wouldn't you? Like a tie-in with biggest metal band in the world. But no.
Mind you, it's not Triumph, it's Smith's Triumph team, isn't it? Which is kind of a side...
I am.
It's a satellite team, really.
I'm trying to remain tactful on this one because I work for Triumph, so. yes. Yes, I think more should have been made of it. I think it's a tie-up of two legendary brands.
Yeah.
I'm kind of sad that it wasn't.
Yeah.
That's all I'm going to say.
A real missed opportunity.
Shall we move on?
That's all I have to say about that.
Yeah. Because I like my job.
But it's... completely lost where I am now. Live band.
Tangents.
They're an amazing live band. They always pick really decent support bands as well, though.
No, they don't.
When I saw them first, they had My Dying Bride. When I saw them in Gothenburg, they had Opeth.
Okay, so I know of the fact that they have had Trivium support them.
Okay, yeah.
And when I saw them, they had Avenged Sevenfold and Temptations.
Yeah, okay. All right, then.
That was at Twickenham, and it was an amazing gig. Really big.
Not because of Avenged Sevenfold.
Not because of any of the support acts.
Because Avenged Sevenfold can fuck off.
Yes, as we established in episode zero.
It never hurts to restate it, though.
I saw someone with an Avenged Sevenfold t-shirt walking up my street the other day.
Did you tell them to fuck off?
I felt like it. I laughed.
Hi, sir. You know nothing about music. Here's an Iron Maiden album. You'll notice that it sounds a lot like Avenged Sevenfold, but less shit.
Going back to Ron Smallwood's financial genius.
Yes.
Iron Maiden actually got the UK chart singles chart rules changed.
Yeah.
Bring Your Daughter to the Slaughter.
Oh yeah, because the BBC banned it, didn't they?
No, wasn't that. They got the chart rules changed because it was Iron Maiden's first number one single.
Yeah.
The way that they managed to get the first number one single is they released it in the first week of January, which is traditionally the quietest. I mean, obviously nobody buys singles at all anymore.
Yeah. But
back when people did, the first week of January, you had to sell the least number to get a number one because everybody had bought the Christmas number one.
Yeah.
And had got no money left after Christmas. But what they did is they put it out on a massive number of different formats. So you've got a 7-inch single, a 10-inch single, a 12-inch single, a picture disc, two CDs, a cassette, something else.
And people are buying all of them.
And Iron Maiden fans, because they've got such a strong fan base who want to collect everything,
yeah,
bought all of them, got it to number one just for 1 week, completely dropped down the chart the week after. And the chart company actually changed the rules so that I think you could only have like three or four formats.
Yeah,
after that.
You weren't allowed to. There's also a rule that you can't have giveaways, badges, posters.
I think that's stemming to the same thing.
Yeah, if you have anything like that, it disqualifies you from being positioned in the charts.
Yeah, which I know. I don't know if that was changed for Iron Maiden, but. I know that when the Wild Hearts released Sick of Drugs in 1995, the CD single had a little mat which you could water and it grew.
Teenage Fan Club had a single, Norman 3, which came with Teenage Fan Club masks, and you could choose which member of the band you wanted to be.
And Tracy is wearing one.
Yeah, I've got my Gerard Love mask on.
So, I think we're about done with that, aren't we?
Yeah, I reckon so. Go buy a ticket to see Iron Maiden.
Definitely, seriously. When we were one of the earlier podcasts that we were recording, when we were walking, I was walking back to the bus stop, Iron Maiden were playing at the arena just round the corner.
Yeah.
And there were just hundreds of people walking down there. You could spot all of the Maiden fans because they were all wearing Iron Maiden.
But yeah, like that was like that in Gothenburg. Like you could tell. I think the population of Gothenburg had basically doubled because of Maiden fans. Probably not doubled, but it definitely in the city centre was ridiculous. Like over 50% of the people I walked past have got Maiden shirts on. Crazy.
So, thanks for listening. Next episode will be Jay, where we will be talking about the Jesus and Mary Chain.
Jam Master Jay.
No, there is another band. I can't remember who it is.
Yaesu.
Jellyfish.
No.
Who is it?
I don't know.
Japanese Voyeurs.
I don't remember either.
I just checked the list and then cut this bit slightly.
Japandroids.
Is it Jenny Lewis?
Japan.
No, she begins with L. Where is my list? Oh, that was it, yeah. So next episode is the letter J, where we will be... Is it J?
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah, it is. Next episode is the letter J, where we'll be talking about the Jesus and Mary chain and Michael Jackson.
Ah, yes.
That was it. That's it. See, I remembered it.
Not Japanese voyeurs. Japan. Japan droids.
No.
Anyone Japan based.
Jeff Healy band, that'd be H. So, thanks for listening. We've been We Dig Music. Bye.
Bye.
Hello, and welcome to...
Oh, you've gone completely into Radio 4 now.
Hello and welcome to Fuck Off. A new podcast about fucking off.
Oh, sorry.
I'm just going to wave.